Hi, my name's Dave Farley, and welcome to the Engineering Room podcast, where we seek out influential and interesting people from the world of software. Some of the world's best developers and thinkers to pick their brains to discuss their ideas, and occasionally to challenge my own on what it takes for all of us to make better software faster. The Engineering Room series is sponsored by Equal Experts, and I'd like to thank them for their ongoing support. So if you'd like some help building some great software, or are interested in finding a great place to work, please do check out their links in the description below. My guest today is a software architect. She was a principal system architect for The Economist and Wikimedia Foundation and co-founder of the Mentrix Group, a consultancy providing enterprise systems architecture, technology strategy, team leadership and systems development services. So if you've ever read The Economist, donated to Wikipedia or contributed to the World Monuments Fund, you've interacted with systems that she helped to create. She's also an author with a recent, very well-regarded book on systems thinking and has a strong background in enterprise strategy, solution architecture, dynamic team leadership, software engineering, coding, and creating the ecosystems that grow innovation. Please welcome Diana Montalion.
Thank you.
Welcome, Diana.
Thank you. I love the very well-regarded part. That was my favorite part.
Well, everybody that I've seen that's read your book has given it glowing praise. I'm partway through, so I haven't read it all yet. But the bits that I've read, I've enjoyed a lot and lots to think about.
Well, you're living it too. Like you're reading it, but you're living it, which is probably more valuable than my words. Yeah.
Yeah. So your book is titled Learning Systems Thinking. So why does that matter? Why should we learn that?
So one, it's titled Learning Systems Thinking because O'Reilly is better at naming books than I am. That wasn't the original title.
What was the original title?
Mind Shift.
Okay.
Which they were like, no one's going to know what that means. But in part because, the book came out of both the pain and the bullshit. Like my editor said, you need to put it in the book. But then they wouldn't let me write bullshit. They put like the growlicks to get rid of it, right? But that, like most of us, right, I had been part of digital transformations, a part of the incredible amount of change we've experienced in the last 20 years. And yet the I call it hitting the iceberg, right? The digital transformation and then just the chaos that happens. And these patterns are so consistent that it's almost painful. And so I started to become really interested in why are we struggling so much with change, which is why I love your shirt today. It's the perfect shirt. Why are we struggling so much with it? And so the book really came out of trying to both describe the challenges that were really holding us back, but instead of just complaining about them, which is the thing I was doing for a while, just yelling at the tidal wave of drama, I tried to talk about what works. So what helps us when building modern systems, changing the way that we think and approach and communicate and code, what actually helps us and what's holding us back. And so that's where the idea for the book came. And then O'Reilly actually asked me, someone had said, oh, Diana's working on a book. And they said, well, we'd like to see the proposal. There's no code in the book. That will not make everyone happy. And they did, and they were terrific. They were so good to work with.
Nice folks at O'Reilly.
Yeah, I really, and I got the people that specifically were part of the team that worked with me. It was a great fit all the way along.
Yeah. So if I can quote you back to you, one of the things that I can't remember whether you said this in the book or in one of the videos that I watched online, but so you said somewhere, instead of building software, we're building systems. And that resonated quite strongly with me because it seems often to me that the mistakes that we often make are kind of in the gaps between the pieces. And so could you explain a little bit by what you mean by that? So in
Sure. Yeah, so and it's both it's so from the system science point of view, the one of the most important things about systems and systems design is that relationships produce effect. So most of the time when you're having these reoccurring challenges, it's in the relationships between the parts. I say it's a great day when the bug is in the code because usually it's an eventual consistency, right? So, from the system science point of view, what you're saying, what we're experiencing, we have, decades of support for that. From an experiential point of view, I started, like most of us who've been around for a while, building monolithic software. And then we were decoupling, and then we were doing event-driven, and then we were doing, and the challenges we had when we were building a single piece of software, the approach to that, they don't, it doesn't scale when you're building relationships between the parts. And so that's how those two things came together. My own experience of how, what was working and what wasn't working for us as we were building software, and then the fact that it's not in systems, it's the relationships between the parts. That's where we look to both improve and to change systems. So that was my experience too.
So I think that one of the ideas that you, or two ideas that you tend to counterpoint are reductionism and systems thinking. And while valuing them both, I think I just wondered if you could explain what you meant by that, just to make sure that, we're all understanding what it is that you're describing.
Yeah, and it's very it's such a challenge. It's been a challenge for me to find the language because what I mean by what I call linear thinking, reductionism, it's so familiar to us and it's so what we've been taught that we think of it as thinking, like that's thinking. So sometimes it's sort of explaining water when we're fish. Like it's hard to understand that our approach to software in over or maybe not over emphasizes, but definitely strongly emphasizes a particular type of thinking, but it is only one type of thinking. And that is that when faced with complexity, that we break it down into parts in order to be able to understand it. Object-oriented programming. My first professor used a car as his analogy to help us understand object-oriented programming. So you have a class that encapsulates the braking system, and you encapsulate the steering column, and then the software becomes a parts orchestrating together to make a car. When we learn in a linear way, meaning you develop foundational skills and say Golang, and then you do harder and harder things that are more complex. The challenge is, though, that once we've broken things down into parts, we then think we can understand the system by understanding the parts, and it doesn't work the other way. that we can create boundaries in a system. We can understand particular patterns and ignore other patterns. We can frame the way we're looking at it, but we don't actually understand how relationships produce effect, right? Because like you and I said, most of the juicy bits, most of what we really need to know is happening in between them.
Yeah.
And so systems, it's about when you have two parts. So let's say two pieces of software that communicate, say via an API, they share information. Same with two teams. What we're really looking at is when those two parts are working together, you get a third thing, which is what you get that neither of them could do alone.
Yeah.
So that's called emergence, right?
Yeah.
And that when you're designing, increasingly what we're designing in software, especially information systems, is for emergence. For how do these relationships get us something that we couldn't get from a monolith or we couldn't get from one team?
Yeah.
And that's where systems thinking comes in, because reductionism or linear thinking helps us to sort of try and gain control over one piece of it, but it doesn't help us solve systemic challenges.
Could you give us an example of emergence in a system? Just something straightforward.
Yeah, so trying to think of the I'll give a people example first. Mm-hmm. Right, so from a people example, I think I'm really good at talking business because I understand that the words being used by the business side or by the marketing side until I do it. And then I get a lot of red lines on what I've written, geek, tech, like that I apparently am not very good at it. And so I've learned in my career to partner with people who are. Mm-hmm. And often I'm trying to get budget for something I need in the tech. And maybe that person is trying to solve a problem and they're talking the business budget language. When we work together and we influence the message, when we communicate together, we get a message, an artifact, a pitch for money that is much more likely to succeed. Yeah. Because now we've merged that. So between people, it's increasingly, for me anyway, important. And also, even though I'm an engineer, if I haven't coded on a particular part in 3 minutes, it's changed. I'm not the expert then in the room. And so partnering, the way that we work as a team, we often, if there are four or five of us, we can deliver something none of us could do by ourselves. And that to me is when you have a team really able to innovate and change, is when the relationships between them produce solutions that are better than the individuals would come up with.
Yeah.
In the software, the reason to say decouple the front end from the back end, right? When we have a relationship between designing software whose primary purpose is to provide the users with the tools they need to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. And then the back end or the multiple back end, the sources, their primary purpose is to make it easy to put information into the system and also to share the right information in the right context at the right time that enable users to do what they can do.
Yeah.
And so often from an information point of view, the user experience of a piece of software tends to improve significantly when the software is in relationship to other information sources or to services that can respond asynchronously,
yeah,
as opposed to a one trip to a MySQL database. So increasingly, at least in the software systems that I'm focused on, we are better able to create opportunities for information to be more robust, more interrelated, more graphical in nature than we could when we had a monolith. And so a lot of the microservices aspects do that for us too, right? It lets us be able to design software that can do with information more real-time appropriate responses to things, which is a little more abstract than I wanted to come up with, but a simpler one didn't come up.
That's okay. It seems to me that so emergence can be good or bad. We can get behaviors that are emergent, that are positive and reinforcing what we want. And as you say, we can design to try and prefer the behaviors that we would like to emerge. Or
exactly.
Or we can get surprised and we can find emergent behaviors that we didn't plan for, and those are probably more often very common, you know, that often certainly in modern distributed systems, that those are the principal sources of bugs.
Exactly. And that was so, I mean, who hasn't pushed something to production that did a thing they did not intend it to do? I mean, I certainly have. I kind of feel like it's a rite of passage, you know. Maybe not taking down production, but you really need to mess it up.
Oh, I've definitely done that too.
Right? I was so afraid of it. And now I'm like, nah, it's kind of cool in retrospect. But so we focus a lot on trying to control, keep that from happening, to make sure nothing goes to production that doesn't work exactly the way we expect it. Which is great. But that can also limit the positive side of emergence where, an example that comes to mind is the like button on Facebook. That was just a thing. Like, it wasn't a big thing. It was just a thing. They even didn't really want it for a while, and then they put it out. But that changed human behavior in a whole bunch of ways. That like button had the tremendous impact that was not intended. So we get both sides. The question is, can we design for learning? Like, when we put something out into production, can we also hope and design for letting then positive emergence happen? People do things we didn't expect, or the software has benefits that we didn't design for.
Yeah,
we get both, but we tend just to focus on the problematic ones, the ones we didn't want.
Sure. So if I'm interpreting how you're describing systems thinking in this context, then systems thinking is an organizing philosophy of structuring our thinking to try and manage our systems so that we get the positive, more of the positive emergence and less of the negative. Is that reasonable?
That would be a very big part of it. Yes, right. One of the challenges, though, is that so linear thinking includes hierarchical thinking, top down, and yeah, concerned with control. And a lot of our language reinforces that, right? Reinforces that we want to try and have control. And in the practice of systems thinking helps us become a lot more comfortable with the fact that we are not in control.
Yeah.
that is delusion. Like we're somewhat in control. And so it's also about, in line with the question that you're asking, right? It's also focusing more on learning, on the fact that outcomes and processes and the things that we do are going to teach us whether it's a good outcome or a bad outcome. So it's moving away as well from being overly concerned with control and overly concerned with a hierarchical way of decision making, and focusing more on Conway's law.
Yeah.
How do we create, how do we think well together in ways that deliver a system that thinks well together? And how are we able to adapt as things change? Are we able to do that in a more fluid way? So it's both. It's both the, we want more positive emergence and less stuck in the mud in the software.
Yeah.
And we also want the ability to adapt faster and to leverage each other's knowledge and expertise to be able to understand what we need to do at any given time, which is not what we're, when we're operating in engineering silos, we don't have either of those things. And we need both of those things in order to accomplish what you're suggesting, right?
So it's interesting. As you're describing that, I'm imagining, so I'm thinking about the kinds of systems that I've been designing for a very long time and the nature of those designs. And I think they operate on two different levels. So I'm a strong proponent of techniques like test-driven development, infrastructure as code and all those sorts of things. And I think about those as techniques for, as far as I'm able to control the variables. I'd like, certainly at some level, I'd like my system to be as deterministic as I can make it. But certainly for larger distributed systems, the kind of systems that we're talking about, it's not deterministic in that sense. So design then is about managing the scope of the determinism at some level, and managing that in a way where we can get the emergence between different parts. This is how I'm interpreting what you're saying, is the systemic thinking is how we can organize things so we can be deterministic where we need to be, and relaxing the need for control outside, because we're going to design things in a way that they're going to use an old engineering term, fail safe if something goes wrong. So we can use approaches like ports and adapters and things like that to give us some insulation between the pieces in the conversations, to so that we've got some wiggle room. We can change things safely without imposing change on other parts of the system. We can make sure that we're getting the right kinds of conversations going. And if we haven't got the data that we need, we can wait for it or whatever else, and manage all of those kinds of interactions. Does that make sense as a description?
Yeah, it really does. And that's the thing, right? Is that we don't want to adopt systems thinking in a way that we just like make a mess of everything. Like, who cares? We'll just, you know, throw things yeah. out. And that's not that. There's elegant simplicity is hard yeah. and really important, right?
Yes.
So for me, the question often is, depending on what it is that I'm thinking about, right, is that one of the questions that we don't ask ourselves. So let's say I'm building a microservice, right? And it's new and it's going to add the ability for the software system or the users to do something that they want to do, they haven't done before. The way that I think about that microservice, I'm much, much more deterministic in that way. In other words, I'm trying to use and craft the outcome I want with the language that I'm building in. And for the most part, I want it to do what I want it to pass the test, right? I'm going to learn a lot about and change as I'm building it, right? As I'm learning and building, and as you see the impact on it. And that's great. And I think that you don't need a lot of systems thinking in that situation. As a matter of fact, it sometimes makes it more convoluted. At the same time, we forget that we are actually adding something that we hope improves the capabilities of the system as a whole. That we aren't just building the one microservice, we're also impacting the experience of the system, the way it works as a whole. So often, it's pretty rare that we have some description of the capabilities of a system. We tend to focus on the requirements of the pieces, but not the highest value behaviors that a system supports. And then when we make a technology decision, adding Kubernetes, building a microservice, we're also designing it to improve those capabilities, to be in good relationship with the rest of the system. And also when we do know really why this matters to do, we can often write better software because we come up with, well, if the goal is for the users to get real-time data about their order, for example, right? And that's the service that I'm building. If I actually understand how the information flows across the system now and what are the events involved in that capability of knowing that, then when I'm being deterministic in the software, I can also make better design decisions using my own expertise about that piece of software that might not have been in the original requirements, but I can improve the relationship with the data about the order, for example, and I can work with that team and we can improve how that data is coming out through an API so that I can get better structured data so that my service can be better, so that I can improve the ability to get real-time information about an order. So that's, for me, the difference between them.
That seems to me to pull out a kind of important nuance of the art of design and architecture to me, which is thinking at multiple levels. And I think I'm playing back something that you've said in public before as well, which is this ability to kind of, you know, think at multiple levels pretty much at the same time. You dance, it's a little dance between, you know, you're thinking about, you know, each of the pieces. We want to be as deterministic as we can, but in the context that there's parallelism and, you know, eventual consistency and whatever else in your system is going on. And you need to take that into account so you can defend the integrity of your deterministic pieces to work in that environment. And that seems like a reasonable defining distinction of somebody thinking at a systems or architectural level and somebody thinking more at the, you know, raw coding level, perhaps.
Yeah, and it is, I call it we're going up and down the micro macro scale.
Yeah.
And it's very, someone asked me once in an interview, which is so fair, said, you know, Diana, I'm already really busy. And it sounds like you're saying I need to think about everything. And, you know, and I, right, it can sound like that. And I definitely don't mean that. And also, as complexity increases in a software system, nobody can do it alone.
Yeah.
It is through thinking with other people that we can go up and down the scale, right?
Yeah.
And so in the sense of, if Conway's law is the case, and I've never not seen it be the case, then the communication between people, so if product hates tech and tech hates product, you can see it in the code, right? You can see it in the way the system operates. So the going up and down the scale is the macro micro scale, right? Is also about forming better knowledge sharing so that when I'm working on the service, I need to focus on the service. But I also need to understand the bigger picture, which means that that information needs to be readily available to me. And that if I come up with an idea that could potentially improve how the outcome will be experienced, I can share that idea and work through it. And often that's more the barrier than the tech. And that was kind of sad to me because I, like most of us, I wanted to solve all the world's problems with technology. And I like applying a technology solution to a people problem. But unfortunately, it doesn't work, which is kind of too bad some days. But yeah, so Danella Meadows in Thinking in Systems, she says that we think that we understand two because we understand one, and one and one make two. But we forget we also have to understand and.
Yeah.
And for me, that's the art and science of architecture, is the and. What impact does the and have? So being deterministic in software, in a lot of ways, is just being a master of the skill. Like, we want to make really good software, but software is only good in context. You can have the greatest piece of software that does nobody any good.
Yeah.
And it really, then that, what is that? Or, and you can have like many instances of terrible software.
Yeah.
That's kind of doing its job. So we want to design well, but also the and is going to have more impact. And that's the word I've been using a lot. Like, what's the benefit of practicing, of systems thinking practice? And for me, it increases our impact. It increases our ability to do something that has impact. And it increases our ability to have influence enough to get what we need to have that impact, which I have found has been a really big part of building software, that if I can't make a good argument for doing things well, then I'm not going to be able to do things well. And that's very frustrating for us over time.
Yeah, I think that you and I are talking about very similar ideas, and probably in slightly different terms. So I have come in recent years to spend quite a lot of time talking about the importance of outcome focus, which you mentioned earlier, really, or at least that's how I interpreted it, which is, you know, we're aiming for goals. You know, my goal isn't to write beautiful software. My goal is to write software that's useful to somebody for something. And so I need to understand the thing that makes it useful, and then produce something that achieves that thing and verify that I've produced that thing. But that's what we're looking for. And as you say, that's a more systemic view. It doesn't matter. The detail of what it takes to achieve that thing is less important than achieving that thing. And so being able to focus on those outcomes and think in those sorts of terms is an interesting idea. And part of my thinking, one of the things that I observed, one of the light bulb moments that I had in my career, was long time ago, learning to switch from procedural programming to object oriented programming. I had this moment where I suddenly realized I'd written a lot of C before that, and I was learning C++. And I suddenly realized that an awful lot of the code that I'd written in C had disappeared altogether and ended up in the relationships between the parts of my code. It was in the connections between the different, you know, objects and so on. And there was behavior there. And that's a different, weird way of thinking about it. But I do think that's what we're talking about here, these sort of systemic behaviors and organizing out thinking to component. And that's on a smaller scale than we've talked about so far. But I think it's the same idea. And that's deeply part of the design. So we're designing the algorithms and the implementations of the pieces. And we're also at this separate level in your dance, your micro, macro, you know, levels of thinking, we're also designing the conversations between them, the interactions between those pieces. And both of them are conscious aspects of design, but they're different.
They're different, and they're different in different circumstances. Like what might, you know, something you could do that has impact in one software system doesn't matter in another.
Yeah.
But to what you're saying, because that you gave me this sort of light bulbness. One, because I started in C++, and for me it came much later with Golang, where I'm like, where the hell do I put this variable? Because it's so reliant on relationships that I'm not even sure where behavior is originating in the code. It really, because I did a lot of PHP early on, which is lovely because I can make it as linear as I want it to be. And so it made me realize that, you know, so I teach, and increasingly the writing and facilitating learning is what I'm focusing on, because so many of us have this pain that we need to come together and sort of figure out together how we're going to evolve. But really it comes from when the first time that that my team and I were building breaking down Monolith into microservices, our microservices were very tightly coupled because our brains are very tightly coupled. And then I began sort of 10 years of these information systems that are fundamentally knowledge graphs, like that's what they are.
Yeah.
And having a hell of a time trying to have conversations about how you take CRUD software or monolithic, all the software that we're used to, and design based on events, and design collections, data that is more ephemeral, and materialized views, and how you design topics in Kafka, and realizing that our brains just freak out now because we don't have a lot of practice thinking asynchronously, thinking about knowledge flow, thinking about that a system doesn't have one source of truth when it's asynchronous. There is a source of truth, but also truth is just the moment that you're in.
Yeah.
And little things like with web software, we know that when somebody goes to a restaurant's website on their desktop, they're usually looking at the menu. But when they do it on their phone, they're usually looking for directions, so that the information people expect is incredibly in context.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to design software that gives people a different experience depending on the context they're in, with a linear approach to how software shares information, and those that doesn't work. And that's getting worse in quotes, faster. And it's going to continue in that way. So it's exactly the work that we're doing demands that we start thinking this way. We don't really have that much of a choice.
I'd like to pull us back a little bit to something you said just then, which is about the nature of events and asynchrony. That seems something that to me is deeply part of this kind of the tools that help us to get this more systemic approach. When we're talking about the conversations between these parts, I've come to the belief, I agree with you entirely that we're not used to thinking that way. But I also think that it's kind of deeply true that the universe is actually asynchronous and event-based. It's, so if we are to be building systems that better fit, the world, the universe, then modeling them that way is a more effective strategy. I'm I spent a large part of my career working in distributed systems, and we've been talking around the edges of that. I think what you talk about the step from linear programming to systems thinking, I've kind of thought of as the step from simple systems to distributed systems. And they're vastly more complex when you go to distribution. But I think that a deep part of the toolkit is this event-based programming in asynchrony. And if you embrace those as part of implementing distributed systems, once again, a lot of the incidental complexity tends to disappear into the edges, into the connections between things. It's easier then to cope with these still complex problems, still. And that's one of these interesting learning points as we're growing bigger, more complex systems too, it seems to me.
Yeah, and one of the really basic ways that I've seen this play out is having a discussion about an API and how, so there's information in the database that I need to share with other software parts. So I will put it out, we'll build an API and we'll put it out. And I say, okay, but what will come out then is how we've structured this information to store it in a relational database. But the consumer of the API doesn't care what the labels are and the structure is to organize the information for a relational database. They are asking for information in their context. Yeah. So they'll want, say, JSON with the labels that describe what the values, what the payload is that they're getting. Right. And also then when you introduce, say, GraphQL, then they don't want all of it. They want to be able to get some of it. Realize that my career is basically trying to keep regular expressions out of consuming API. If I need to write regular expressions after I've hit an API, then maybe we could design this conversation between software parts better. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so, that sorry. Please.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to kind of reinforce that the reason I took a step back and talk about systems thinking, not in all of these specific examples, is because just trying to make visible the skills we would need to do that. And some of them are really not things we think of as tech skills, but the reason is because we're faced with these exact challenges that we really know how to evolve.
So what's some of the practical advice, the techniques that you would recommend to start applying this kind of systems thinking to somebody that's not used to work thinking in those terms?
Yeah. So one of my favorite books, Design Unbound, is written by an architecture professor, a literal architecture, buildings and spaces and things. And yet I quote it so often, it's so relevant to us. Same with agriculture. Like, our systemic problems are not unique to tech. Yeah. These are universal. Michael Nygaard and I had this wonderful echo to right the same day that you and I were chatting, that basically the nature of the universe is a knowledge graph, is an information graph. That's like the foundation of things. I love those philosophical kinds of discussions. But at the very, very basic level, one of the things she talks about is empathy as a skill. And by empathy, I don't mean feeling with, although that's part of it. I mean being able to take other perspectives,
yeah,
and understand that the reality is going to be the integration of different views of a system. So we tend to take, the tech view. We need Kubernetes. Why do we need Kubernetes? Because we don't have Kubernetes. Like, there's probably a systemic reason, right? And so A lot of the core practices that, and it kind of trips us up a little, is first to become aware of our own thinking patterns and how often those thinking patterns are about sharing our opinions about things. I love opinions. Opinions are great. I have lots of them myself. But opinions, my opinions, don't allow other people to understand how I came to a conclusion, to help them understand my point of view so they can synthesize it with theirs. And so a lot of the foundational work really is on becoming aware of your own thinking patterns, noticing how often you rely on logical fallacies. How often you don't really give a shit what other people think. You're not like, right? And that's not a bad thing, but it will hinder us. Also, how often we're reacting instead of responding, how often we hear something we think is stupid, and then we just start generating noise instead of offering another point of view that might help. And so a lot of the basic practices, they aren't really about coding better or tech, they're about noticing how entrenched and impactful our current ways of thinking and communicating are, and beginning to think more about synthesizing information, integrating information, and still recommending the best possible next step forward. And this is why. These are the reasons that convinced me this API structure would benefit the system as a whole. Just practicing being able to make recommendations in a bit more integrative way. And also noticing when you're adding to the noise. And can you develop the ability to add some signal? By this, I mean like something to do rather than just being mad at everything, which I also love to do. So that was a hard sell as a technologist. That was a hard sell to be like, no, this is a tech subject. I have not like abandoned technology and gone off because it is our own mind. Everything in our own mind is what will push to production. Like, that if we can't change and work with our own thinking, there is no hope of doing that in the world around us. And so the first step is that metacognition, being aware of our own thinking and the patterns in our own thinking and improving them, and then improving them with other people in the artifacts we create, the way we write documentation, the way we comment our code, the way that we design the software. All of these things are impacted by, in systems, the smallest pattern scales to the things we're reacting to. So everything that, if there's an outage in production, there's a whole bunch of structures and patterns and ideas and opinions underneath it that caused it. And so we have to start at that lowest pattern, and that is our own, that's our own ideas about what our skill set should be.
So before we pressed record on this, when you and I were chatting, we were talking about the juxtaposition of, or the relationship between architecture and engineering, and systems thinking and engineering, I suppose. And certainly part of my definition of engineering, the way that I think about it, is engineering are the kind of the guide rails that help us steer us in the direction of the set of more likely to succeed solutions. So when we're talking about that kind of I was trying to avoid saying using this term, but top-down approach to design, of thinking about the context in which we want to place bits of the bits that we're trying to organize and think about, that seems still to be a function of engineering to me, to be able to think about these things in the right context. So one of the bits of advice that from your book, I think, is see the whole picture. And so being able to think about things in the context in which they're going to be placed, and understanding, and this is again this dance between the macro and the micro level, which seems so important. Does that make is that a way that you would see it? So systems thinking is a way of organizing our thinking to try and get us in the direction of what's going to more likely to work for us.
Yeah, and enabling the flow of information. So, yeah. You know, what we were, because it makes me chuckle, right? That, oh, the endless fights about architect, that word architect, yeah. Engineer. And I've gotten tired of them. Like, you know, architect's a bullshit role. And I'm a hands-on architect, right? So first of all, there are as many definitions of that word as there are people doing the practice, right? And, yeah. And I do, like, everything, like every good idea can be implemented into a horror show and vice versa, right? Yeah. So I struggle with the word, but more I struggle with the our inability to define it. For me, though, I think of it as a facilitation, meaning I'm not the smartest person in the room. If I'm the smartest person in the room, I'm in the wrong room. Like, I really want to work with people who are brilliant at what they do.
Yeah.
And that I need the other people in the room. I have no actual value all by myself. Like, right? And we need the relationships between us are important, yeah. for the system. And so some of us focus a lot more on implementation. Some of us focus more on the structure of knowledge flow and information across the system. Some of us make more artifacts that are in a spoken language, and some of us make more artifacts that are in code. Mm-hmm. And for me, the architect and engineering, I don't love the idea of, you know, you become a principal or a senior engineer, then you become an architect, because most of what they're doing, I would say, is engineering. And that's great. That's wonderful. Yeah. Like, there is no hierarchy. There's more about, I spend a lot of time doing systems design, knowledge flow design, yeah. trying to make a repository of information that's useful to people, that brings, how do you even see a capability in a system in the 700 decisions and ADRs yeah. evolved in it? I think about that more than some of my engineering colleagues, but that is also part of self-organizing as a team, right? And most of the people I work with that use the word engineer, partly because of the work I do, tends to require this skill set, but they're brilliant at the architecting part, right? And so to some extent, it's like any household. There's a bunch of stuff that needs to get done, and you sort of self-organize. I love doing the laundry and I hate doing the dishes, yeah. so I do more laundry. One of the things, though, that I think we need is to understand, the way I mean systems architect, that there is a blind spot to that skill set, that we often don't think it matters. So we don't value it as a skill set, or we think it's not tech enough, it's not hands-on enough. But if you've been in situations where no one is actually thinking about and, then you know what happens. Yeah. Or if the and is strictly a product requirement role, which it is not. That is not all it is, right? So the more people can synthesize information, the less need for very strong definitions of what a role does, and more how do you get on with doing what needs to get done.
I agree. I think the labels that we apply certainly in this space matter less, but they're tools too. I tend to use I tend to use the term engineer specifically in relation to other disciplines as a kind of metaphor for what we do. Not really a metaphor. I think it's an accurate description. So what I'm thinking is that an engineer the model that I have in my mind when I'm thinking of an engineer is somebody working at NASA designing a Mars rover, that kind of thing, not somebody repairing your car. So it's not about technical skills. It's about following a defined process. It's kind of practical science. It's following a defined rational process for organizing our thinking in a way that allows us to solve systemic as well as reductionist problems.
So I love this. So I have a story. I put it in the book because I like this so much. So I had a cat who got very ill and brought the cat to the vet, who said, nope, this is an emergency. You have to go to the emergency clinic. Four different veterinarians with very concrete, this is what's wrong with the cat, were wrong. One of them sent the cat home and the cat almost died. We brought it back. So the chief medical officer of the place came in to me and said, hi, introduced himself and said, I'm going to work directly with you now. And then he started talking me through what they'd done, what they were doing. Now, I am not a veterinarian, and he used language that I had to look up some of the words he used later to understand. But we get about 5 or 10 minutes into this, and I went, we're debugging the cat. And he's like, what? And I'm like, yeah. I mean, I'm not a vet, but I know this, yeah. I know this. And it was so much better because he said what the known knowns and unknowns, and it exactly what you're saying. It made me realize that it's a particular style of problem solving.
Yeah.
And we often confuse a more linear reductionistic style with debugging the cat.
Yeah.
Right. But when you're debugging the cat, it's tech agnostic to some extent. Yeah. But he couldn't debug the cat without medical expertise. I can't debug a software system if I didn't understand how to code. But it's like a synergy of those or something, right? Yeah. I think. Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess this is self-evident, but anybody that, you know, we'd think of as an expert, certainly in our discipline, you know, but probably in any discipline, is going to have a bunch of those kinds of rules of thumb, guidelines that they use, ways of organizing their thinking, but particularly, especially, maybe vitally, being metacognitive about these sorts of things, so that they can kind of, you know, think about the way that they think and try and organize their thoughts so that they're heading in the right direction rather than the wrong direction.
So those
are the kinds of things that that particularly interest me. What are the things that we can say are going to steer us in the direction of getting a better result?
The willingness to tolerate ambiguity.
Absolutely.
Right? And ambiguity and nuance in some teams that I've worked with, they seem like the enemy that's supposed to be. So when people think of deterministic, they often think that means without ambiguity. And that's not the case, actually. You can come to very strong conclusions, very strong outcomes, or very strong pieces of software, and still know that you don't know how it's going to evolve, how it's going to actually impact the system. That you don't. It doesn't have to be So systems thinking, also a form of it is informal logic, right? So informal logic is, meaning how do you come to a conclusion when there's no right answer?
Yeah.
And I think that's where our conversation today, which I've so much enjoyed this. My brain feels happy, like it's popcorn now. Informal logic, how do we come to a conclusion when there's no right answer? And for me, over the last 20 years of my career, that is increasingly necessary. And that why I've gone down this path is because I've worked in so many situations that are still clinging to a right answer. Then you implement it and push it to production. And that just isn't the world anymore. And it doesn't have to be. And it makes for very limited outcomes when embracing the ambiguity and the learning and the fact that everything changes and nothing is certain. Also, the other is like a word I hear a lot, the abstract versus concrete. As we need concrete answers. And it always makes me chuckle because code's not concrete. Code is an abstraction that makes computers, which are completely made up by humans, do things. There's nothing concrete about our work. Like it is all abstraction. We're not planting trees. We're like making shit up. That's what we do. And that's what we want to do. We want to make shit up. That's what we do, right? So
That's the job.
maybe we can stop fighting about the difference between concrete and abstract and instead find ways of communicating our ideas in ways that are actionable and understandable without worrying too much about making sure that we've sucked all the uncertainty out of it, because you can't do that. It's not possible. So
It always strikes me when people sometimes say the same thing to me about, we'd like a more concrete example. It seems to me that what they really mean is that they'd like a recipe to follow, step by step by step
yes.
to get a predictable result. And if it was that simple, I could write a program to do it, and we'd all be out of a job. But it's not that simple. It's much more complicated than that. And it seems inherent to what it is that we do.
And I use that also in the book, the recipes, and in the book I'm writing now. We're asked to write recipes. But in order for us, what I was writing is a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. We're asked to write documentation about how to make one. But if you are going to have expertise, you would know how peanuts are grown and when they're picked and what their impact is and how much salt or not and what is jelly anyway and which are the fruits. Are you have to know all of that to make a really excellent sandwich. And sure, you can write a recipe, that's perfectly fine. Also, the O'Reilly team, we were talking about something, and Melissa said, which was my favorite day, she said, well, recipes are important and a lot of people need them and we still want to publish them. She said, but your work though is more about being a chef. And I'm like, this is my favorite moment of my career. Feel so seen. And that as a chef, you absolutely interact with templates and recipes, but it isn't point. The point is the relationship between the ingredients, produce, effect, and how do you play with that relationship in order to make something that suits your circumstance? And
I think that's saying something fairly deep about what software development is all about, because it is more like being a chef than having a recipe. There's no one right answer. There's a whole variety of right answers. You can make fish and chips, you can make burgers, there's a whole range of stuff, and it's all good. There's a lot of stuff that's not very good. Mustard on salad is a bit weird. And or the things that we might be able to rule out, But we can narrow the scope of things that are reasonable choices. And it seems to me that that's the best that we can do in terms of steering us to make those choices. And then you need smart, thoughtful people, smart, thoughtful groups of people interacting and engaged to think about things in the terms that you've been describing, to come up with some shared picture of what it is that they ought to be building and build it. And that's much more complicated, much more fluid than trying to find, you know, as I say, if there was a simple recipe, we would have written a program to do that years ago. There isn't one solution to any of these things.
There isn't. And that was somebody that got to like the first or second chapter and said, no, where are the templates and checklists? I'm like, yeah. No, I wish I could give you templates and checklists. But like Danella Meadows said, if I know a system, I can come up with leverage points, meaning I can talk about where you'd make a change that will actually improve the system as a whole. So often, you know, nowadays, moving towards event-driven, for example, is an example. But a system I don't know, she said, it takes me months. I have to dance with it. And the idea that, you know, we can take something that works in another context and put it here.
Yeah,
sure, because there are some fundamental principles that do generally apply and hold true. And that's the thing for me. Not just can we code, but can we discern when to apply what?
Yes.
Like, when does this best practice actually hold us back? So we need to evolve it.
Yeah.
And when is the, this worked great for us and it's not working anymore, as opposed to we change everything because we love new tech. So as soon as the next version comes, we take a new tool. That discernment is takes time, and it takes skill to have that discernment. And one other thing Danella Meadows also says is that we know from bitter experience that when you do discover a leverage point, hardly anyone will believe you.
Yes.
Right? Because everybody thinks they know the right answer.
Yeah.
So part of it too is this tolerance for learning how to communicate in ways that help cross-functional thinking. Like, if I solve problems with JavaScript, how do I talk about JavaScript and the solutions that I'm building to be able to get more buy-in for the way that I'd like to do things, that increases our impact. So it isn't just writing excellent JavaScript, although if you write it poorly, it'll be bad and everybody will not use it. But in order to do it well, it isn't just the quality of the code, it's the outcome, as you say, right? It's the outcome. Yeah. And that requires discernment too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that neither of us has said, but I think that both of us are thinking, is that there's this continuum that goes code, design, architecture. They're all facets of the same thing, and the ways in which we talk about those things change depending on which context we're in. But the ideas are kind of consistent. So I can write code in JavaScript and come up with a good idea that's actually an architectural idea and will work for C# or Clojure as well. You know, so it's interestingly complicated. And this gets back to those multi-levels of thinking again, I think. The different level, there's probably more than the two. It's not just micro and macro. You know, it's more nuanced than that, it seems to me. But software development,
yeah, and circle,
bloody hard. That, I think we can agree.
Yeah, but that, like, in a circle, when I come up with for the platform that we're building now, for example, when I get together with my teammates, I expect to leave with a different thing than I came in with,
yeah.
Because we need each other to to improve it, to do it, see it differently. And that, so it is also a very lateral skill. Like, how do you, and then how do you know when you don't change your mind based on feedback, right? There's, it's a lateral skill. It's an up and down skill. It's a speaking truth to power skill. Yeah. And it's also the ability to have really good tech skills, because the tech has constraints that you can't do miracles with with it. And you have to understand those constraints as well, and the opportunities and that it gives you. And so,
I think we're probably coming to the end of our time. So is there anything that we should have talked about but haven't from your point of view?
There are a million things that it could be, I would love to talk with you about, but nothing. I think the only thing, the one thing I want to leave with, I think, is that I think the most, one of the most, one, the biggest predator to this, like you and I are saying, hey, if, as soon as you've been around a while, you come to realize this matters, whatever the words we use, we don't even have to call it systems thinking, doesn't matter. Derision is the predator of this change. And we are a culture, man, that we seem to really like being derisive towards, well, anything, right? Whatever. Yeah. And to, I think becoming aware that our derision isn't helping us. And it especially, you can't do informal logic when somebody involved isn't willing and consenting to do that, when they just want to say, change my mind. And so the being able to actually contribute feedback that strengthens the thinking, as opposed to just derision. And being American, this is on my mind a lot at the moment. And it's not good thinking. It's immature thinking. So that's the one thing that came to mind, I think, is that you don't have to, I absolutely do not agree with everything that I think a lot of things I hear, I just want to bite somebody. Like, I definitely don't agree. But also, the what do you do in that situation as an engineer, I think we're a little lazy about that. And that's one thing I'd like to see get better.
Yeah, it's I definitely agree with you again on that. But there's some good writing. There's a great book by Carl Sagan called Demon Haunted World, in which he enumerates an anti-bullshit detector and he kind of lists these ideas. I made a video that kind of enumerated them a few months ago, just being self-indulgent. But it's hard. It's hard to find ways of thinking to be rational. I part of my background and part of my love of science, I tend to use science as a model, because I think science represents pretty much the height of human endeavor, the height of human creativity, and it's a, you know, we come up with algorithms in effect for trying to avoid fooling ourselves largely, and that's what science seems to me, and I think that we could do with more of that in software development. We could do, we could find, there are better ways in which to have a discourse about ideas to try and find the best ideas. And I think that's important.
That's a brilliant ending. I'm applauding from here. I'm like, jazz hands. That's a beautiful summation. That I want to get it tattooed. I'm going to say that on quote Dave Farley. Yeah, I love it.
Thank you for listening. These discussions are aimed at helping us all to push our discipline forward. If we've helped to change your perspective on the things that we discussed here today, please do leave the podcast a review, as it will help us a lot to reach a wider audience with our show. Also, let us know on Twitter or other social media channels if you've got suggestions for guests that we really should talk to. Similarly, if you have any thoughts on our discussion here today, please do let us know. The best way to get in contact with us is through our Discord, which you can access via Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode today, please do consider supporting the show, either directly through Patreon or by leaving us a review.